You guys sounded great on that. Give yourselves a hand. That was, I'm serious. You did a good job. That was great. You guys sounded great. Good morning. Welcome to Morgantown Community Church. We are thrilled to have you with us as we continue in on the season of Lent. And we're going to jump right in just a second. But I just had a couple things I needed to go over with you first. When you came in, hopefully you were given a program, but there's a really important announcement that's not in the program, and that is that this coming Saturday, we have an opportunity with the jail ministry. There's going to be a meal at the jail on Saturday night. It's the Saturday the 16th at 5:30, and there's around 50 inmates we try to feed each month, and so if you can help with that, there's a sign-up sheet out at the connection point, and we'd love for you to just put down what you can bring and all that, and somebody will be in contact with you about how to get that there. So that's not in the program, but it's very important, and so please check that out. Also, we have our second annual Daddy and Me drive-in, and that's next Sunday night. These blue sheets are at the connection point if you would like to fill one out. And dads, if you have a kid, I mean, I think preferably little kids. If you try to push your 16-year-old around in a cardboard box, that's going to be difficult. But if you have smaller ones and you'd like to participate, we did this. My son and I did this last year, and it is such – he still remembers doing it. It was such a good time. So please grab one of these forms, fill them out, and make sure Adria gets them, and so we can be prepared for as many as we're going to have. And finally, I want to address a typo in the program that I said this week when it was brought to me. Hey, do you want to proofread this? No. I'll go for it. Never mind. It's my fault because I didn't proofread it. But if you look at the Stucco bake sale, it's a mashup between the bake sale announcement and our Lent sermon series announcement. So I want to read the part in question. Please contact Jessica White if you can provide baked goods to help out our kids, that their hold on us can be broken. So I don't know. I don't know if that's our prayer today. Like, God, let them be 18 soon. Maybe that's your prayer today. I don't know. But if it is, peace be with you. And also, there's one more on the Daddy and Me drive-in announcement in there. It says, bring your pre-schooners. But no boats, please. Just children. Just your preschoolers, if you could. So that's that. This week, when I was on the way in, a friend of mine was handing out programs. And he said, so what's the sin of the week? And so we're going to talk about greed today. And that last song that we just sang, it's so powerful because it asks, and it really the question that we're going to wind up asking today is that very question. What are we going to do with the life we've been given? My buddy Harold Dean, the bass player extraordinaire, we were talking before the 9 o'clock service, and we were talking about the importance of now, that a lot of times we spend so much of our energy looking back at the past and regretting things that happened in the past, which unless you have a really cool DeLorean, we can't go back and change, right? That is, past is past. There is no going back. And we spend so much time fretting about the future when we can't go into the future and see, you know, we have this one moment. And so really the question that we want to center in on today is, what are we going to do with this life in this moment? We can't change tomorrow today. We can't go back to the past and change yesterday. But we can think about how we're going to live now. Because how we live now will determine how we live tomorrow. And so really the question, we're going to talk about greed, and we're going to talk about, and I thought about this as I was preparing this. You know, when you talk about pride, not a lot of people get mad about that. Because when you talk about pride, we don't really want to see that in ourselves. So we like, you tell them, brother, you tell all those proud people. I'm actually proud that I'm not proud. You know what I mean? Like, I'm proud to be unproud at this moment because of all those bad, prideful people. And we can, you know, we don't really get mad about that. And we can talk about envy. And we don't really get that mad about envy because we're just proud that we don't envy other people, right? I mean, we don't envy, everybody should envy me because I'm the best. But when you talk about greed, you can't talk about greed without talking about what? Money. And I heard somebody say once, so people get funny when you talk about money. And it's true. And so like by the end of the message at 9 o'clock, there's kind of like this, you could hear a pin drop. It was like we were right for a Sprint commercial. And so I realized that some of the stuff we're going to talk about today is going to be uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to me. It's uncomfortable to think about it because I don't want to think I'm a greedy person. But when you look at what Jesus says here, then it kind of catches, I think, a lot of us. But I do want to say this. I realize that I am preaching to the choir when I talk about greed a lot, because we do in this community have some very generous people. There are some of you who give more of your time and resources. And the reason we get to do what we do as a church is because you give. You give your money, you give your time, you give your talents, you are fully engaged and on board. And we couldn't do what we do without you. So I just want to say thank you. Before I talk about greed, and before I talk about, I want to recognize, did you know last week, Richie Christy came up here and talked about cancer assistance, and between the two services, we donated over $2,000 to that. So that's, yeah, give yourselves a hand. So choir, and you guys sound like a choir this morning. You sound so good. So we're going to talk about this because what I've learned is with these seven deadly sins, I can address it today and be fine with it today, but there's always tomorrow. And I want to make sure that what we're trying to do is not just deal with this in this moment, but really prepare ourselves. How we live today will affect how we live tomorrow. So really work today on figuring out how do we make sure that greed doesn't become a problem in the future. So we're going to jump right in on that after we have a word of prayer. Let's pray. God, grateful for this day. It's just been beautiful. Grateful for all the gifts that you pour into our laps constantly. And we just pray today that you'd give us an awareness, an openness, this topic, because we're going to talk about money and we're going to talk about our possessions. And ultimately we're going to talk about our hearts. And this is touchy ground. It makes us uncomfortable. We want to squirm a bit. We want to be defensive. And I pray that you'll help us to hear this and that the response will not be guilt, because this is in no way about guilt. Guilt doesn't produce change. Guilt makes us feel bad for a minute and then we forget about it. We're desperate for change. We're desperate for a fresh perspective. We're desperate for new ways of looking at the gifts you've given us. So would you just guide us, take the stuff I've prepared and just do with it whatever you want. We open ourselves up to you in this time. And we pray in Jesus' name. And everybody said, amen. So we're going to talk about greed. And, you know, greed is one of those, I've said this, I think, every week, but with these seven deadly sins, we kind of live in a world. This is kid-proof. We live in a world that really has tried in many ways to take the things on this list of the seven deadly sins and we've almost tried to baptize them and make them good. Like we've tried to take vice and make it a virtue. And I think greed is one of those clear areas where we can see that in our world, we really have taken what the ancients would call this terrible, destructive, nasty soul fungus called greed. And we've tried to make it a good thing in our culture. And so, and that's clear, I think, when you look around at our country, for example. We're coming through an economic recession that we're coming out the other side of. But the reality is that in many ways, greed put us in that, you know. So, but yet greed, it can't be that bad, because all greed is it's trying to get more and it's trying to do better. And we're trying to give our kids a life we never had. And we're trying to, you know, we just want to do better. We want to get a little bit bigger, a little bit nicer, that can't be all bad. Can it? And so we've tried to take greed and we've kind of said, you know, the people who made this list of the seven deadly sins, this was like in the 6th century that this thing got compiled. Surely we've evolved past this and we would never have a problem with greed like they thought we would. So greed is a good thing. How many of you saw the movie in the 80s, Wall Street? Okay, Michael Douglas plays Gordon Gekko. And I want to read this. This is part of the famous speech he gives in the movie. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all of its forms, greed for life, money, love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind. And greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. And you know what people do when he finishes his speech in the movie? Yeah! Right. Greed is good. Greed, it's survival of the fittest. It eliminates people who can't keep up. Greed is a good thing. If we want to get better, if we want to do better, if we want to be better as a country, if we want to be better as people, what we just need to be a little more cutthroat and a little more greedy, and we'll get ours and we'll be okay. And if everybody else can't keep up, that's their problem. And there's part of us right now that wants to give a heart. Amen, I think, maybe. You know, and really, if you look at it, there are lots of things you can look at about greed and say, maybe it's not, you know. So I get why as a culture we want to say maybe greed's not a terrible thing. But here's the problem. Jesus keeps insisting that it is. And so for me to take seriously this way of life Jesus has invited me into, I have to question these sorts of things. I have to question greed. I have to question what greed can actually do to the human heart, which is our ultimate. It's not just that you're greedy, but greed does something to the human heart that was never intended to be done. And so today we're going to just jump in to greed. And I want to give you, if you have a Bible, Luke chapter 12, but I want to start with the definition. That may make it easier to see what we're working toward. In his book, 7, Jeff Cook says, greed is not gluttony, which indulges to the point of bursting. Greed, in many ways, couldn't care less about enjoying its spoils. Greed's not about enjoying anything. Greed pursues accumulation. Greed is the desire to possess more than I need because of fear or idolatry. We'll come back to those two words, fear and idolatry. Greed is a desire to possess, not enjoy. You know what I think of when I hear that? I think of Ebenezer Scrooge in Dickens' Christmas Carol. Because there's this, just you get this image of him sitting behind his desk, stacking his money and counting it, never enjoying any of it, never giving any of it, just piling it higher and higher and higher and counting it and taking joy in just knowing how much he had. I had a family member who, when she passed away, they were going through her things and they found like $10,000 in her freezer. And like she was carrying a cool five in her purse and she never went anywhere. And a matter of fact, she used to get angry if the store shorted her a penny and she would try to send people back to the store to get the money for her. And she, to me, fit the exact characteristic of somebody who's so miserable, but they just spend their time counting their money and yet they're miserable. And so I don't think that's who we want to be. And I don't think that's who God made us to be. So I want to look at this. We're going to look at another parable Jesus tells. Because Jesus' stories have a way of just cutting to the core of an issue and kind of cutting through all the stuff we like to prop up and say, oh, but maybe it's this, and maybe this is, maybe we can make this seem better than it is. And Jesus says, I don't really think you can. So Luke chapter 12, verse 13, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." So at this moment, Jesus is surrounded by a crowd and somebody in the crowd decides that he's Jesus' boss and he's going to tell Jesus what to do. He says, "Jesus, you tell my lazy, rotten brother he needs to give me my share of the inheritance." Now, this inheritance issue, the way it worked, and there are all sorts of passages. If you go to Deuteronomy 21, if you look through Leviticus, there are all sorts of passages in the Old Testament that detail inheritance laws as a way of making sure there weren't a lot of squabbles and fights about who got what. Aren't you glad that we live in such an evolved, advanced society that nobody would ever dare fight or argue over some inheritance? Aren't you thrilled that we're just so evolved. Nobody would ever take somebody else to court and sue them over. And it just doesn't happen anymore. This is ancient, okay? This is a very, very backward way of thinking. But there are these inheritance laws. The older brother, if there are two brothers, for example, the older brother would get 2/3 of the estate and the younger brother would get 1/3. Now, the estate, we're not talking about like cold, hard cash here because they didn't deal so much in cash as much as they dealt in land and in sheep. And so you wouldn't get like $1 million. You would get like $1 million in land and sheep, right? And basically, the land here is central. The land was about social standing. It was about status. They believed God had given their ancestors this land. And keeping this land in their family, in their tribe, was crucial. And so they wanted to make sure that the brother who inherits most of the land is going to be level-headed. He's going to do a good job and he's going to take care of what he'd been given because it was crucial to keeping the family name. So this inheritance is a big deal. Now, Jesus is a teacher. He's a rabbi. He's not a legal expert. And so notice Jesus' response. Jesus, as a rabbi, wouldn't have made these sorts of decisions. He says, "Man, who appointed me a judge or arbiter between you?" Then he said to them, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." So right away, initial reaction, what is Jesus' stance approach toward greed? Is it a good thing? Notice the language he uses. Watch out. Be on your guard. You know what that tells me about greed? That greed isn't this big hairy monster hanging out in the corner waiting to get you. Greed is more sinister and subtle. Greed's something that creeps up on you. It slowly takes over your thing. It slowly takes over your heart. It doesn't happen all at once. It's a slow burn. It's a slow process. C.S. Lewis, who I just love, he put it like this. "Prosperity knits a man to the world. He thinks that he's finding his place in it, while really it is finding its place in him." Isn't that true? I mean, I don't know anybody who woke up in the morning and said, "You know these seven deadly sins? I just want to go try them all. I want to be prideful. I want to envy everybody. I really haven't been lusting enough. Let's ratchet that up a few notches. I'm not angry enough. I'm not slothful enough. And you know what? I'm just not greedy." I don't think anybody wakes up in the morning and says, "I'm going to become a greedy old miser who is unfun to be around and unfair to others." I don't think anybody starts out and says, "That's where I want my story to go." That's because greed is subtle and it slips up on you. And it grabs you when you're not looking, and it does something to your heart that hardens your heart, not only toward others, but also toward God. So Jesus, he warns them, be careful, because the moment you think, I'm too good of a person. I'm too generous. I'm too compassionate. I'm just never the kind of person who could be greedy. Jesus says, watch out. In that moment when you think you've got this thing licked, that's when you're in danger. So then verse 16, and he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to keep my crops. I have no place to store the abundance that I've brought in. Now, Jesus is speaking to a crowd, and most likely the crowds who followed Jesus around were filled with people who are, we would consider like peasants. They were people who are like very, very, very bottom rung of the ladder economically in this society. And in Jesus' world, the average person lived in poverty. The poverty line was 90%. You had 10% with all the stuff and 90% with nothing. So the 90% who are listening to Jesus tell this story, try to put yourself in their shoes. Jesus begins a story about a rich man whose field yields an abundant harvest. He has so much, he doesn't know. When's the last time you had so much money you didn't know what to do with it? Right, put yourself in this. If you've been in that situation recently, can we please talk after the service? But I mean, this is not where we often find ourselves. I've got so much, I don't know what to do with it. If you're in Jesus' audience hearing this for the first time, do you know what he should do with it? What should he do? Share. Because my family's starving. My family doesn't have enough food to eat. I'm not going to be able to feed my kids tonight. And you don't know what to do with it? I know about 10 families who are not going to make it through this season if they don't get some crops, if they don't get some food. Why don't you go and take it around their neighborhood, and why don't you feed everybody that's hungry? You have more than you know what to do with. But notice, I love how this story plays on out. Notice this. Not really love, but it's interesting what Jesus does. So he doesn't know what to do. And here's what he says. Here's what I'm going to do. Bingo. It came to him like a brilliant idea. Genius. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. What do you think Jesus' first listeners thought when they heard this? I mean, this is vile. They're starving to death, and this guy has more than he needs. And what does he do? He's filled his barns to the brim and realizes, I've still got, so here's what I'm going to do. Those barns, I mean, they're old, they're dated. I'm going to rip those barns down, and I'm going to build new super barns, and I'm going to put everything I've got in my super barns. And then I'm going to retire early. I'm going to sit back. I'm going to eat. I'm going to drink. I'm going to have a really, really relaxed, easy, good life. My life is going to be smooth sailing from then on. That's what I'm going to eat, drink, and be merry. I'm going to build bigger barns. I'm going to take care of myself. I love how the Message puts this. The Message translation. The word, by the way, for self, or when he says, I'll say to myself, in Greek, it's the word suke. It means soul. I'll say to my soul. And the Message does as well. Then he said, here's what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. Then I'll gather in all my grain and goods. And I'll say to myself, self, you've done well. Do you ever talk to yourself like that? I'll say to myself, self, you've done well. You've got it made and can now retire. Take it easy and have the time of your life. Self, you've done well. Take life easy. Retire. Throw a good party every now and then. Eat, drink, and be merry. Now, when I studied this passage, I was interested. It was interesting to find out that most people who write about this passage say this rich man is guilty of two things, not just one. He's guilty of two grievous sins. The first sin is that he did not share his abundance. He had more than he needed, and he consumed it all for himself. He didn't think about the people around him who had nothing. And then two, he stopped planting. He opted for early retirement. Obviously, he didn't need anything else, so he could go back out and sow his field again the next season, and he could make more and give it all away, and he could sow his field the next season and make more and give it all away. But instead of thinking about others and being generous, he decided he was going to just bail out early, cash it out, relax, lie on a beach somewhere, and never really have to be bothered by anything difficult again. Instead of helping others with his extra, he hoarded it all. And then instead of making more, he just walks away, and he leaves good ground fallow. Nothing to be planted, no crops to grow, no hungry bellies would be fed. I mean, the very nature of his question, what shall I do, as he looks at his surplus, it reveals, I think, a truth about this rich man, and that is this rich man did not know any poor people. When you have that kind of abundance, and you have to ask yourself the question, what am I supposed to do with this extra? It kind of leads me to believe that he has actually isolated himself from anybody who is below his socioeconomic standing. He's created a bubble for himself. How many of your kids like bubbles? Anybody have kids that like bubbles? There's this place, I hope this goes better than at 9 o'clock because the bubble show was not working at 9 o'clock. We got some cheap bubbles here. Ooh, that's nice. 9 o'clock did not go that well. You guys get the better show. You know what's neat about bubbles? Kids love these things. I don't see the fuss. There's this place in Bowling Green called Just Kidding, and my son loves to go there. And what's cool about the place is it's full of bouncy houses, but what's really neat is that adults can go in these bouncy houses, but they don't make the openings any bigger. So, like, you have to go through the little kid opening to get in, but it's like, and so, you know, we'll take our shoes off, and he hits the ground running, and he's in a bouncy house. By the time I get, like, all 6 feet, 8 inches of my frame in there, he's out and going to another one, and so I'm trying to slide out. But last time I took him there, we were there the same time these kids were having this birthday party, and guess what some of the party favors were? Bubbles. And we were sitting like right here and the party was right there, and these kids are like coming over our way and going, it's driving him crazy because he wants to get over there and pop him, but you know, we're not invited to the party because those people were jerks. And and so, you know, he wants to pop the bubbles. But you know what I find interesting about these bubbles? When you first look at them from a distance, if you didn't know they were just kind of soap, like if you didn't know what they were, those bubbles look kind of sturdy, right? It looks like you could almost catch it and hold on to it. It looks like you might be able to look at it and check it. But what happens immediately when you touch a bubble? Ugh. I was afraid I was going to grab it like water earlier. That'd be a different bubble show. What happens when you grab bubbles? Doesn't matter how big they are, right? You can get one of those wands and you stick it in the solution. You can put a bubble so big, and if you touch it, it pops. They look sturdy on the outset, but when you really get up next to them, they're really quite flimsy. This rich man used all of his wealth and influence and resources to build a bubble that kept everybody else out. He didn't know any poor people. He didn't know any hungry people. So he didn't know what he should do with his resources. He built a bubble that seemed quite sturdy and quite safe. He built a bubble that would keep him and his kind of people in, the people who, the circles he ran in, the money he had, they would stay in, but there would be nobody who would mess that up. He had this nice little bubble, but the problem, or maybe big bubble, I don't know, he had a lot of stuff. Maybe he had a nice big bubble and he felt nice and safe and secure and isolated from everybody else in his big bubble. But what's the problem with bubbles? They bust, they burst, they explode. Like just when you feel like, man, I can catch this bubble. You see kids do it all the time. They're really careful. Pop. Notice what happens to this rich man. The very night, but God said to him, this, you fool, this very night, today, your life will be demanded from you. This is really, if you read Jesus' parables, this is the only time Jesus tells a story where somebody does something so wicked, evil, and vile that like God acts in that moment and says, you do not deserve breath any longer. It's not the prodigal son who goes out and makes all sorts of bad decisions. It's this guy who does something so heinous that God says, I'm taking your life back. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be, Jesus says. For those who store up things for themselves but are not rich toward God, but aren't rich toward God. What was the man supposed to do? Is this like, is Jesus fleecing him because he didn't tithe his crops? Is that what this is all about? I would argue when Jesus says he isn't rich toward God, he doesn't mean just toward God. He means that in his failure to give to his neighbors, in his failure to surround him, when he creates this bubble that keeps everybody else out, when he's not sharing with people who are poor and starving to death, he's not being just stingy toward them. He's being stingy toward God. Because where do we find God? We find God in our neighbors. We find God in the people around us he's given us to love and serve and show compassion to. And when we refuse, when we build bubbles that keep all those people out, we've essentially not just been stingy toward those people. We have ultimately been stingy and we've ultimately robbed God. When somebody's hungry, when you look at a hungry person, that isn't just a hungry person. That is God starving to death. Jesus actually says at one point, what you've done for the least of these, for the prisoner, for those who've been mistreated, what you've done for the hungry, you've actually done to me. In others, in the needs around us, we find God present. And Jesus says to this rich man, your life is done because you failed to see God in the needs around you. What I find fascinating is that what Jesus alludes to here is it's not just his wealth, but his very life was on loan from God. It's not just that his money, his wealth was a blessing. The very breath he breathed was on loan and a blessing. And when God sees how he responds to blessing upon blessing, God says, you know what? Your loan is being called back because you have lived in such a way that you've ignored me all around you. Not only is the stuff, not only is your paycheck, not only is your house, not only is your stuff on loan from God, but this breath, the next one, and the next one, and hopefully we'll get another one after that, all that's on loan from God too. It's all borrowed. And Jesus seems to allude to the fact here that this rich man failed to understand that all of life, including his lots and lots of crops, all of life is a gift. And that how you use that gift reveals something about how you feel about the gift giver, who for Jesus, this is God. God is the ultimate source of all good around us. But this topic of greed, to me, it's difficult and it's confusing and it's muddy, because we need to go to work and we need to make money and we need to feed our families. And I don't think Jesus is condemning rich people. I think what Jesus would say is, are you rich? Brilliant. That's wonderful. Now go help some people with what you've been given, right? Jesus is not, he's not saying rich people are bad. This issue of greed could happen to anybody. We could all put money and resources as our God. That's not just something that happened to rich people. But Jesus is using this to illustrate the fact that too often we are ignorant of and ignore the needs all around us, and that how we treat others is ultimately how we treat God. So where do you draw that line? You know, I need a line. Where do you draw that line between just good stewardship, for example, and not wasting your money, which is important? You need to, you know, it's from God. We need to treat it wisely. We need to do good things with it. But where's that line between what we would call stewardship and managing your resources well, and when do you cross that line into greed? And I think Jesus gives us insight in something he says right before he tells the story. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. He says, beware of greed, and beware of the lie that you'll begin to believe that life somehow is made up of stuff that you can acquire. Now, what Jesus does here is fascinating. There are a couple different words in Greek that the New Testament is written in that can be translated life. There's this word bios. It's where we get our word biology. It means like living things, plants, animals, you know, trees. The physical life we live is bios. It's physical. Then there's this other word. It's the word zoe. And this word zoe is completely different. It has nothing to do with physical. It has nothing to do with the physical act of being alive. Zoe is like abundant, vital life. It's energizing. It's animated energy. I heard one person say zoe is the life that happens when God breathes his spirit into you and you become fully alive. That's what zoe is. And what Jesus says in this passage is zoe, that life that only God can breathe into you, cannot be acquired by getting more stuff. You can have lots and lots of stuff and be dead inside. You can have lots and lots of possessions and money and resources and friends, and you can be really cool and popular. You can drive the newest and nicest, but in the end of the day, you may just have bios. You may not have zoe. You may not have the life that is life. Jesus says, watch out. And don't you think we need this warning? I wonder how many of us are searching for zoe, for that real full life, and we're searching in all the places that cannot deliver. I mean, how many of us are searching, if I can just get a better job and make more money, then we'll have the life? And you get those things, and it's not what you thought it would be. Or you think, if I could just, we search in all sorts of places. We search in relationships. We search in sex. We search in all sorts of places for this life that is real life, and we come up empty every time. And Jesus says, life, real life, zoe life, is not found in accomplishments or achievement or conquering. It's only found in this connection, this vital connection with the God who made you, when he breathes into you and you become a real living being. It's being connected with something bigger than your stuff. It's being in tune with a God who is larger. Jeff Cook, to go back to the definition of greed that we looked at, he talks about it's a desire to possess more than I need, but because of fear and idolatry. Isn't that true, that fear is a real motivating factor for us when it comes to our resources? I mean, you think about the unstable economy we live in. You think about how, I mean, people have generally just been afraid, right? And fear often drives our choices and how we decide what we're going to do and how we decide how we're going to live. We often live in a constant state of fear. And when we're afraid, this is where idolatry comes in. When we're afraid, we begin seeking security in the quickest, easiest place we can find it. And for lots and lots of people, we look for security in stuff. And we think, if I can just have big enough nest egg, there's nothing wrong with a nest egg. If I can just have a big enough emergency fund, nothing wrong with it. If I can just make more and have more and stockpile more, then when the clouds open and pour rain and everything falls apart, then we will still have security. We'll still have money. We'll still be okay. And there's nothing wrong with emergency funds. There's nothing wrong with nest eggs. They're great things. But the line is when those things begin to become your security and you no longer depend on the God who feeds the birds to also feed you. It's when your entire life is given to accumulating more. So much so that the people around you, the people in your family, the people you love, you're never with them because you're always making more. And you're not making more to give to those who need it. You're making more so that you can feel better. And so that you can lay down in your bed at night and say to yourself, self, we've done well. And that's when we cross that line. Will Willimon, a Methodist bishop, he says in his book on the seven deadly sins, greed is a kind of self-delusion. Since riches have a way of deceiving us that we can attain self-sufficiency. In other words, greed becomes a false god, a matter of misdirected worship. Our greed is not only a matter of desire, of wanting something we ought not want, but perhaps more to the point of idolatry. Money is our main means of attaining what we call security. We buy our security. At his grand funeral, orators eulogized the rich man for his prudence and careful planning. After the funeral of the rich man with his full barns, God named him, "Thou fool." Thou fool. Ultimately, greed is when we place our trust and security in things that ultimately are temporary and cannot come through. I was talking with somebody recently who said, I have more money right now than I know what to do with, and I have no one to share it with, and I'm terribly, 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 terribly depressed about it. I mean, you can have everything and have nothing. You can be loaded and have nothing and be poor in spirit. So what I want to do is I want to walk through some numbers and some statistics, and if you don't see where this is going at the time now, that's okay. If you say what's different about that than any other sermon you do, point taken. But I'm going to walk through some statistics, and I just want to maybe reflect on what it reveals about maybe our society as we think about them. In 2012, the United States, where we live, alone, by ourselves, spent $711 billion on defense. That's more than the next 14 global leaders combined. So we spent more on securing our nation on bombs and planes and those sorts of things than if you take numbers 2 through 15, they still, all those countries combined, spent less than we did in 2012. Next. In 2011, the global total, so if you take all the 100 and some nations in the world and you total what the whole world spent on defense in 2011, and by the way, I'm not really good at numbers, so I practiced reading this all week, so I'm going to really try to knock it out of the park for you. It's 1,546,529,200,000 spent in 2011 on making sure that we had bigger bombs than the other guy, making sure our borders were secure, basically protecting the stuff that we've all accumulated, right? That's what we're defending. 15 million children during the same time, 15 million children die of hunger every single year. That's a third, 33% of world population right now, as we do this teaching in this room in Morgantown, Kentucky, 33% of the world's population is considered to be starving. Every 3.6 seconds, someone somewhere in the world dies of hunger. And Cody, what was that number you told me? Because you did the math. 750 people up to this point in our service. 750 people have died since we started today. Not of untreatable disease, but of simply not having access to enough food to sustain their human life. 24,000 people roughly die every day of hunger. It's estimated that it would take $30 billion over a period of 3 to 5 years to completely 100% eliminate world hunger. So we're talking in 3 to 5 years for $30 billion a year, we could actually say in our generation, in our lifetime, somebody could stand up and say, world hunger is no longer an issue. We have made sure everybody on this planet has access to enough food to sustain life. Nobody's starving. Can you imagine being, like, wouldn't you love to be at that press conference? When somebody stands up and says, somebody goes to the UN and says, by the way, we've all come together and we've made a decision that world hunger is unacceptable. And so we're going to do something about it. We're all going to pony up the next 5 years, $30 billion a year. We're going to eliminate world hunger. In our lifetimes, that could happen. Now think about this. And hear me when I say this. I'm not saying that we don't need defense. I'm not saying that that's not important. I'm not saying that that shouldn't be something. I mean, obviously, we live in a world where defense is a necessary evil in some ways. So please hear me say that. I'm not disparaging our troops. I love our troops. I have friends who are troops. We honor their sacrifice to give us our freedom. Are you with me? But we have to ask difficult questions, not only about our spending as a nation, but as the world spends money, ridiculous amounts of money, on new and improved ways to kill each other, when one of the greatest causes of terrorism in the world today is a lack of resources, a lack of food, a lack of basic needs being met. We spent $711 billion last year on defense, and it would take $150 billion over 5 years to end world hunger. That's under 21% of what we spent last year. If we could get everybody in the world together on this, it would be less than 10% of what the globe spent on defense in 2011. We could actually stamp out world hunger. Think about that. You could tell your kids, your grandkids, your great-grandkids, I was alive when the world got it together and said, no longer. Because the problem isn't adequate resource. It's not that the world can't produce enough food to feed the world. It's that there are some people at the top who get it all and some at the bottom who aren't getting any. And we need to ask these difficult questions. Now, the reason I bring this up is because this is a global problem. This is a problem the world, when the world spends $1.5 trillion on weapons and defense, and we can't allocate less than 10% of that to solve world hunger, that's a greed problem in the world. And it's not just a global problem. It's a societal problem. It's an American problem that we have. But you know why it's a global problem? You know why it's a society? You know why it's an American problem? Because it's a personal problem. Do you know why we tend as a nation to be greedy at times? Do you know why? I'm going to let you in on this insight. It's because I'm greedy at times. Are you with me? Like a country and a world is not made up of faceless corporations, and it's made up of human beings who are making choices every day about how we'll live. It's made up about people every day who are trying to answer this question. This question. What shall I do? I have been given more than I need. I have more resources. And let's just say this. If I'm currently consuming everything I bring in, that is a problem. If I'm currently consuming every bit of my money, every bit of my resources, if I'm consuming every bit of my talent, every bit of my time for personal uses, personal gain, then what I'm doing is I'm looking at the world that is falling apart from so many things that we could prevent, and I'm saying, my bigger barns are more important than your full belly. My bigger barns matter more than you having enough to eat. And yes, it's global. Yes, it's societal. But it begins in my heart, and it begins in your heart, and it begins in us saying, enough is enough. We do not need to live in this society where we believe that we're entitled to everything just because we exist. We need to think long and hard about what we're doing and how we're doing it. We need to ask that question, what shall I do? And we need to hear the voices of millions and billions of hungry people saying, feed us. Feed us. Because the same crowd that was surrounding Jesus asking for help is the same crowd that's surrounding us asking for help. Now, I know teachings like this often, they're like, oh, it's like Sally Struthers just got up on stage. And here's what often happens. We feel really guilty, and we order like one less chicken nugget at McDonald's after lunch, and then we go on about our lives. And this is not, I don't want anybody to feel guilty. You don't need to feel guilty. Guilt produces nothing. Guilt doesn't change a thing. Hungry people will still be hungry if you're guilty. But conviction that that's not right and a determination to change it, that's what changes the world. I don't want you to feel guilty. I want you to feel convicted, because I do. I want you to realize all that we've been given. And I want you to do this simple exercise. This is all I'm going to ask you to do. We're not going to pass the offering bowls again. We're not going to do anything like that. All right? And I know what some of you are thinking, like, oh, this is really a talk on money. And he's a pastor. All he needs is a bigger comb over and a gold chair. He'd be right there on TBN. Like, listen, if you think my motives are impure, don't give anything to us. Take it to the mission. Do whatever you need to do, but just help somebody with it. This is not about drumming up a big, this is just about the world is broken, and we've been called as followers of Jesus to be new creation and try to help God fix it. So here's the exercise I want us to do. Everybody just kind of shake, because you all need to shake out a little bit. A time change, this talk about greed. I said money more than once. You all uptight. All right, everybody shake it out. Harlem shake. No. All right. We need that kid just come across the front right now. Wouldn't that have been perfect if I'd planned it? So here's what I want you to do. I'm going to ask you to take a deep breath with me when I count to three, and I want you to hold it, and I'll tell you when you can let it out. Okay? If anybody breaks the rules around you, stand up and point to them. We'll shame them publicly. I'm kidding. Don't do that. Ready? We're going to take a deep breath on the count of three. Ready? One, two, three. I get to let it out because I'm talking. Keep holding it. Keep holding it. We're going to see who really wants it. First one to let go loses. Keep holding it. People are giving up all over the room. Okay, you can let it out. You can let it out. I want to find out who you were, and I want to have underwater breath-holding contests. I could beat some of you. Not many of you, but some of you. Here's what's great about what you just did. You need that. When you breathe in, what are you breathing in? Oxygen. That's life. Right? Without that oxygen, you don't live. Without that oxygen, you're done. And we breathe in that oxygen. I mean, it's you know what it's like when you feel like you haven't been able to breathe. You've been holding your breath underwater, and you come up and you gasp that big breath of air, and it's life. But if all you do is breathe in, what's going to happen to you? You will die. Because it isn't just breathing in that gives you life. Breathing in provides you with oxygen. But if you don't breathe out, carbon dioxide is going to build up in your system. And ultimately, that same breath that gave you life, that same breath that gave you blessing, is the exact same breath that will turn into carbon dioxide and kill you. You have to release it. And when you release your breath, what does that carbon dioxide do? It goes to plants, who then produce what? This is biology 101, right? You got this. The plant, you breathe out the carbon dioxide, the plants produce oxygen, and what do we breathe? Oxygen. There's this cycle to life. We receive, we give, we receive, we give. Maybe we should start looking at generosity, not as this big load we have to carry around with us all the time to make us feel guilty. Maybe we should simply look at generosity like, it's like breathing. The book of Lamentations says that every single morning, God's mercies are brand new. Every single morning when you wake up and you take that first deep alert breath, for that day, you're breathing in everything you need from God for that day. You're breathing His mercy, His compassion, His grace. And if you have a roof over your head, a car to drive to work, if you have a job, if you have people you love that are around you that you can tolerate, they can tolerate you, maybe you've made that agreement. If you have all those things in place, then not only are you breathing in mercy and grace, you are breathing in ultimately God's generosity. Like everything you have, how much or how little, I don't know, but it's a gift. Every bit of it. And when you breathe that gift in every single day, if you hold that in, that blessing will become a curse. That blessing that gave you life, that blessing that enables you to feed your family, that blessing that enables you to live, will also become the curse that caused God to look at you and say, you're a fool because you thought this is what life was about. Generosity is learning to breathe in what God has given, and it's learning to turn around to the people around us and breathe it right back out again. That's what it is. I'm breathing in the life God gives me, and I'm turning around, and I'm going to breathe life into others, and then I entrust that God every single morning is going to breathe more life into me. You know, we talk about generosity, and people are big on praying for stuff, and I think prayer is great. I think we should pray. But generosity is one of those things. I think you could spend the rest of your life, let's say you're going to live another 200 years, you could spend every single day praying to be more generous. And you know what's going to happen? Nothing. Because when God answers that prayer, you know what He does? He actually has done what he's already done for us. He's surrounded us with all sorts of people who need us to be generous to them. He's given us all sorts of opportunity to breathe out his compassion and generosity toward us onto others. The question isn't, God, when will you answer this prayer? God's question he fires back is, when will you open your eyes? Richard Rohr, who's a brilliant writer and mystic, he says, we do not think ourselves into new ways of living. We live ourselves into new ways of thinking. The greatest way to become a generous person is to sit down and discuss with your family, with your spouse, and it's to make really hard decisions about how we're not going to consume all this, but we're going to find some margin that we can then bless others with as well. And you may be in a place where you're so far in debt, you really literally cannot imagine sharing anything with anybody else. Then will you please let us know? We have people we can put you in contact with who can help you climb out of that so that then you can begin to breathe appropriately. We're just talking about the next right step. The next right step is not for you to go home and to empty out, sell all your possessions and like live in a hut in the backyard of the church, right? We're not starting a commune. Although that would make the neighbors talk, wouldn't it? They're a cult. I start wearing a big hat. It'd be awesome. But we're not talking about that. We're just talking about what's the next right thing? What's the next right decision? What can you begin to do to breathe out some of what God has been breathing into us? Because the ultimate question we're being asked is not what we have done in the past and not what we will do in the future. The question we are being asked today is, what will we do with this moment, with this life? God, I don't know how many more breaths I'm going to be granted, but I know that while I have them, I want to be breathing them out onto others so that at the end of it, lots of people don't stand up and say, oh, he was great, and God says, you're a fool. I would rather people say, he's an idiot. And I'm sure some do. But I would rather God say, that's what you got what life was about in the long run. It wasn't about you. It's about the countless people I put around you. It's the countless people I showed up in. Because I was in the poor, and I was in the hurting, and I was in those people that you so desperately want to build a bubble to keep out. And I was in them, and you recognize that. Isn't that what we want as a church? For God, you recognized me when I showed up in that way, in that guise. You will never think your way into new ways of living, but you can live your way into new ways of thinking. And you can begin to be generous now with what little bit of breath you may have. And it will become as natural as breathing, which I think is the goal. So let's have a word of prayer, and then the band's going to come back up and lead us in one more song so we can reflect on this a bit, and then we'll be done. Let's pray. God, as we take a few moments to reflect, as we think about how much we've been given, as we think about all the ways you have blessed us beyond measure, remind us that not only is all of our stuff a gift, not only is all of our stuff on loan, but our next breath, this life we live, is a gift. May we treat it as such, not as something we're entitled to, not as something we deserve, but as a gift. And may we live in such a way that as we breathe in more and more of the gift you have for us, that we turn right back around and breathe it out and share it with others. May the life we have been given, the life that is not just bios, but it's zoe, it's full, it's real, it's abundant. May we breathe that life into others as you have breathed it into us. We're grateful. We're humbled. And I'll speak for me, but convicted about all the ways we senselessly absorb everything we've been given and use it for ourselves. God, make us the kind of people who see you in all the needs around us. Make us the kind of people who are aware of your presence, not just in a room like this, but in the eyes of the starving, in the eyes of the hurting, in the voice of the broken. That's where you are. God, burst our bubbles so that we can be close to you. Because when we're in their presence, we're in your presence. Pray this in Jesus' name. And everybody said, amen. Let's stand together.